Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I am professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, and I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Mark Navin. His new book is titled Values and Vaccine Refusal: Hard Questions in Ethics, Epistemology, and Healthcare. It's just been published by Routledge. Navin is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Oakland University. Communities of parents who refuse, delay, or selectively decline to vaccinate their children pose several familiar moral and political questions regarding public health, safety, and risk. But additionally, there are epistemological questions about these communities. Though frequently dismissed as simply ignorant, superstitious, or stupid, it turns out that vaccine suspicion, denial, and refusal are positively correlated with higher levels of education and a greater depth of knowledge about vaccine science. Accordingly, the common view that vaccine refusal is the product of ignorance seems simplistic. Yet the more strident forms of vaccine refusal are based on demonstrably false beliefs. How is this combination best explained? In Values and Vaccine Refusal, Navin offers a balanced examination of the epistemology and value commitments of various stripes of vaccine refusal. After arguing that vaccine refusers may be reasonable, he then defends a novel version of the view that there is a moral requirement to vaccinate one's children. He then defends the claim that the state may use coercive means to enhance vaccination. But Navin also makes room for exemptions for non-medical reasons. Navin's book is a fascinating philosophical exploration of some very deep questions at the intersection of social epistemology and social ethics. There's a lot to talk about, so let's turn to the interview. Hello, Mark Navin.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on New Books in Philosophy, and thank you, listeners, for checking out our podcast. My guest today is Mark Navin, and he's just published a great book titled Values and Vaccine Refusal: Hard Questions in Ethics, Epistemology, and Healthcare. I recommend this book highly to anyone, philosopher or otherwise, who struggles to understand an odd and growing phenomenon, that is the phenomenon of vaccine refusal. And there's a lot to talk about here, and perhaps some of what there is to talk about is surprising. And we'll get into some of the ways in which this topic has philosophical surprises built into it in the course of the discussion. So there's a lot to talk about, and as the subtitle of the book suggests, there are some hard questions about epistemology and ethics to be hashed out. But before we get into those details, we usually begin these interviews with a statement from the author about him or herself. So, Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I grew up on and near military bases around the country. My father was a naval officer. We moved very often. And I was interested, I think, at an early age, relatively, in politics and history and in war. And I suppose I had philosophical interests in those topics about liberty, equality, possibility of peace, though I suppose I wouldn't have known those were philosophical questions. I don't think I was first exposed to philosophy until Slippery Rock at the College of Bard sent out Defense of Socrates in its application materials, which is just a great idea. I wish more colleges and universities would make their applicants read and respond to philosophy to apply. I didn't end up going there. I went to Cornell, where I majored in philosophy, and I took as many classes as I could with Dick Miller and Henry Shue. In fact, I think I majored in them. Probably not the wisest choice.
You could do much worse.
I could do worse, but I have some regret about all the other wonderful faculty I did not take classes with. I was on an ROTC scholarship with the understanding I would have a career in the military, and I regret that I wasn't as serious a student as I might have been, because I was planning on a military career, and the military really didn't care about my philosophy class grades. But the don't ask, don't tell policy got in the way of my military career, and so I had to go a different way. I taught high school for a couple years. And I fell in love with teaching, and I wanted to teach the university level. And Henry and Dick convinced me that I might have a career as a philosopher. And they supported my applications to graduate school. I was very lucky that University of Pennsylvania admitted me, since I had, frankly, a very mixed undergraduate record. And I ended up writing a dissertation on Rawls and global justice under Coq-Tortan, who had just written two books on that topic, and supervised as well by Samuel Freeman. And with the support of Paul Geyer, who helped me think about some of the Kantian themes in the Rawlsian global justice literature. I was very, very fortunate to be hired into my job at Oakland University, which is, I tell people, the best school no one's heard of. I was hired in 2008, just before the market tanked. It's a relatively teaching-intensive position, but I've been fortunate to have time and support to do some research, but also build a family. I have three children, perhaps this is a nice way to segue. It was my experiences as a father more than as a philosopher that propelled me into thinking about vaccine refusal.
Excellent. Well, why don't we pick up there? Because, it's always nice when an author begins a book with an explicit statement about the experiences or the motivations otherwise of his or her getting involved in a project. So this book comes with a pretty interesting story of that kind. So as you just said, being a father has put you into pretty direct contact with a community of people who are suspicious of vaccines, maybe that's one way to put it, or have some stronger still negative attitudes towards them. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences as a father and then how that got you thinking philosophically about the issue? And then maybe tell us, in addition, a little bit about the community, the community of vaccine refusers and how diverse it seems to be.
So, sure. I have three small children, and I have friends who are refusing some vaccines that are on the recommended schedule or on the school and daycare mandated schedules. I have other friends who are delaying those schedules for vaccinating their children, choosing not to do, for example, more than one inoculation at once. And I have acquaintances. I confess I don't have any close friends, but I have acquaintances. I know a number of people who are not refusing, that is to say, not vaccinating at all. And I was very puzzled. I think I began the book by saying I was angry and convinced these people were irrational or excessively emotional or just stupid and maybe even evil. And I wanted to think through that because that did not mesh with my experience of these folks as very thoughtful, as committed parents, as good citizens. And I wanted to think through that a little better. And it might help just some terminology. So many people, depending on the poll, upwards of 40% of parents who are polled are vaccine hesitant, as say they are not sort of enthusiastically committed to the consensus view about the safety and efficacy of vaccines on the standard schedule. That's a sort of position of a sort of skepticism and a reluctance to act. There's another term, vaccine denialist, So a vaccine denialist denies, as a matter of belief, denies some part of the scientific consensus about vaccines. And a vaccine refuser, this is a matter of action, is someone who refuses to follow the recommended or mandated vaccine schedule. They can do it in a selective way. They refuse some vaccines, or they can do it in a delayed way, or they can be an absolute refuser. Levels of absolute refusal are quite low, 1 to 2%, but very large percentages, upwards of 10 to 20% of people are delaying or selectively refusing. And in some communities, the rates are quite high, substantially higher than that, especially in some schools. Especially in some private schools. We have some private schools in the Southeast Michigan area where upwards of 50% of students are missing at least some of the school mandated vaccines on exemptions, which I suppose we'll talk about later. Sure. So that's it. But I want to say something about what some of the philosophical interest is, if that's okay, because I don't want to just say, it was a personal interest and I want to work through my personal issues. I don't think that would make for a good book. Maybe it'd be a different interesting kind of book. So one thing to say is just, more people have died from diseases than from all the wars in the history of humanity, and major disease outbreaks have often been a source of social upheaval and civilization collapse. So if vaccines had been around when Hobbes and Locke were around, I'm pretty sure they would have written about them. They're amazingly important piece of political technology, in addition to medical technology. But it's a weird one, because mass vaccination, while it's an explicitly political project, and vaccination has from the early years been political, and not just a matter of medical preventative care. It's one that we make happen through the contributions of small children and infants. In fact, we take healthy infants and we impose a non-trivial risk on them in order to create a public good. We don't do that for jury trials or military service or anything else. It's also a weird intersection of the relationship between parents, predominantly mothers, and physicians in a context that looks like it's about care for the child, but really is overlapped with all these other levels of social and political consequence. And just more generally, the more I started to look, I thought arguments being offered by advocates of mass vaccination were often sloppy or just didn't go through. And so at the very least needed to be reformulated or thought of differently and sometimes outright rejected. And that's what propelled me into this. I thought I'm a philosopher and I've got a hammer and this looks like a nail I can hit with it.
So just to get the terminology straight, so would you say then that vaccine refuser is the most general term that captures the different grades from vaccine hesitant to vaccine denial? Should I be asking you about the vaccine refusal community?
Well,
would
I think
inclusive way?
So I think vaccine refusal is the topic of the book because it is often motivated by vaccine denialism. In most cases, I think, motivated by vaccine denialism, and emerges from vaccine hesitancy. And it's a sort of action that then calls forth we have moral and political judgments we want to make about it. Whereas something like vaccine hesitancy, I think, is actually perfectly reasonable and morally justified and not a political problem, generally, at least in some ways. So my focus on vaccine refusal, but I do think of vaccine hesitancy as an important distinct phenomenon, right? You can be hesitant without being a refuser.
Right.
Yeah, and people who are refusers are no longer merely hesitant. They've made a choice to act.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
So this community, then, of people who are concerned, suspicious, there's an interesting series of facts about them that counts against what I take it is a pretty standard view about this community. Could you tell us a little bit about the demographics that we're talking about?
Sure. So people who refuse vaccines, in particular people who selectively refuse or do delayed vaccination, are on average better educated, financially privileged, and this is the kicker, have more accurate beliefs about vaccines than people who fully vaccinate. The most common, least popular explanation for vaccine refusal is that it results from certain cognitive deficiencies, sometimes called the deficit model. That is to say, the vaccine refusers lack knowledge or lack appropriate epistemic dispositions or just unwilling to do the cognitive work they need to do to come to accurate beliefs and right actions when it comes to vaccination. And I think,
or that they're superstitious in some
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. And I think there's not good evidence for that, or at least there's not good evidence that they're uniquely deficient cognitively compared to people who vaccinate. So people who vaccinate ought not to be self-satisfied as individuals, at least. I mean, they can praise themselves, I think, for being part of institutions that are better functioning at getting to good answers about safety and efficacy of vaccines, but they ought not to valorize their own individual epistemic capacities.
Right, and they're well-educated, but also that they, those who are in this community of people who are at least suspicious yep. of vaccinations, also tend to, looks like they know more about the vaccinations.
Well, so they have more true beliefs about vaccines. They spend a lot more time reading, and there's this idea that they're just reading crank websites, and they certainly are reading crank websites. They also are reading both summaries of scientific research, and they're out there reading actual research papers. They are thoughtful, and they're deliberating, and they care about getting to the truth, but they are led astray by, I think, a variety of aspects of both our individual reasoning and our sort of social, political reasoning that are common, right, across behaviors. I do want to resist the idea that there's this one community. I don't think you're saying that, but sometimes people right. say, well, there's this community. And I think there are lots of different kinds of overlapping communities that often are organized around other themes that lead to vaccine refusal. So there's a community or communities of people involved in what you might think of as intensive or alternative parenting, specifically mothering practices, to which vaccine refusal has become attached. So extended breastfeeding, co-sleeping, early potty training, organic baby foods, baby wearing, vaccine refusal has been attached to that sort of practice. Among some sort of libertarian-ish communities, vaccine refusal has been picked up as a practice. Among people who are concerned about environmental pollution or about safety in food and other consumer products, vaccine refusal has also been attached. And so I think it's helpful not to think of there being one community, but perhaps lots of different communities with overlapping memberships and lots of different motivating concerns that lead to refusing vaccines.
Right. And I take it that one of the philosophically interesting sort of entries into the issue is that among all of these communities, it looks as if the standard way people, I think, are inclined to think about these communities doesn't really look accurate, right? That is that the deficiency model doesn't look like it matches the demographic. These aren't people whose attitudes towards vaccinations are explicable simply in terms of ignorance or superstition or stupidity or something else.
No, that's quite right. Now, some of them do have false beliefs, but they haven't reached those false beliefs through mere ignorance. They've reached them through reading and contemplation and deliberation with others and often lengthy exchanges, often online, about these issues. There's a lot to valorize about the epistemic communities that these folks have often formed. And in one part of the book, I talk about the gendered aspects of these communities that we know, for example, that upwards of 90% of visits at the pediatrician's office are visits that mothers take children to. We have evidence, at least among vaccine refusers, that they experience the pediatrician interaction, especially surrounding vaccines, as being one that's paternalistic, sometimes disrespectful. These mothers often feel as if their testimony about their children's medical histories, about their reactions to vaccines, have not been granted sufficient credibility. Often these are these parents, especially mothers who've been involved in vaccine refusal, they know something about the history of medicine, about the abuses of power involved in practice of medicine. They may themselves have come out of childbirthing experiences where they were sort of treated in paternalistic or disrespectful ways, or at least felt that they were. And so oftentimes these vaccine-refusing communities are deliberately formed alternate epistemic spaces for people who feel that they weren't welcome to engage in deliberation in the more mainstream context. And that's not to blame the pediatricians. They've got 7 minutes to show up in the room with the shots. They don't get paid for the half hour they spend talking to parents about vaccines, especially if there's no vaccination at the end of it.
Yeah, and often they've got a lot of patients, and they're there's a long list of people in the waiting room.
Well, and they're often financially incentivized to not have these people in their practice, right? So in my area, we're increasingly seeing pediatricians just kicking parents out of the practice if they don't vaccinate. In fact, my child's pediatrician just last year decided to no longer admit parents refuse vaccines. And so one reason is financial, not just they're not getting reimbursed, but that there are various incentive structures built into the insurance company's reimbursement models in the new accountable care organizations, such that if they don't have certain levels of vaccination in their practice, they can get dinged as well.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. But let's pick up on the theme of the ways in which these epistemic communities seem to embody certain kinds of virtues, as
sure.
you were already sort of pointing to these communities, epistemically speaking now, as reactions against what look like pretty obvious epistemic vices, right? Not listening to the testimony of people whose experience prima facie at least looks like it should matter, or the people who are closest to the phenomena, being paternalistic epistemically.
Yeah, yeah.
So you describe these communities as having a sort of being more democratic in their epistemic structure. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, they talk about the importance of parents' knowledge of their children, the importance of parents' questions being answered, and the potential to learn from other parents about their experiences. So one of the striking things about people who do have vaccine reactions and vaccine complications, adverse reactions to vaccination are real. One of the striking things is that very few physicians have seen more than a handful of them. But the experts of adverse vaccine reactions are parents who have had them and have talked to other parents. And so a group online of 30 parents who've had children with adverse vaccine reactions actually have more experience of that than your average pediatrician. So there's real knowledge there that your pediatrician is not typically accessing. So there's a democratic allocation of authority, right? People's experiences of their children, people's knowledge as parents comes in, but also this idea of parent research. And it's sort of made fun of. People make fun of Jenny McCarthy for saying, famous quote, "The University of Google is where I got my degree from." And certainly Googling something is not a way to become an expert, but there are ways that thoughtful people doing citizen research can combine their own experiences with sort of deliberation with others and research to form a community that possesses knowledge that ought to be valued and ought to be brought into connection with more mainstream sources of authority on these issues.
And just picking up on the authority claim, so there is a way in which there's a healthy sort of way to take a kind of adversarial stance towards a purported expert community that in democracy we're well attuned to, right? Now, what goes wrong, though, with these communities on your account has to do with the sort of the group effect of this kind of anti-expertise or anti-authoritarianism
at
the epistemic level sort of going unchecked.
That's right.
Is that right?
Well, I mean, and maybe there's something a little question begging about my response here, right? So I want to say, at the one hand, the failure to recognize differences in expertise, right, leads these communities astray. But of course, members of these communities will respond to me and say, well, we deny that the medical folks are experts. And then I want to say, well, you should be paying attention to the meta-experts, right, when we talk about peer review or about degrees. But even if that sort of argument, who the experts are, is not going to get us anywhere. And in fact, there's a robust social science literature that says the people we identify as experts are those that we perceive believing or being committed to our core commitments from the get-go. And so that might not get us anywhere. But I think the more powerful objection I have to these communities is an unwillingness to come into creative tension, an unwillingness for any adversariality with mainstream medical communities, right? So here I'm sort of drawing on, and throughout this part of the work on Jose Medina and Miranda Fricker and Sandra Harding, Learning Code, on this idea that the value of these alternative resistant epistemic communities is so they can cultivate some knowledge that can eventually be brought into constructive tension with the mainstream communities. And when these vaccine-refusing communities act as mere support groups for parents, and are actively resisting questioning and deliberation and discussion with people with whom they disagree, they're systematically being led astray.
And the mechanism by which they're led astray sort of looks well theorized, at least by social epistemologists, in that all the biases kick in about evidence and confirmation, and it also looks as if there's a lot of overconfidence that starts kicking in because of the constant affirmation from the community that you're committed to saying is the only community that is worth talking to. Is this right?
That's right. Well, and it's a problem when your very community identity consists of rejecting the mainstream view, right? So there's no we all know that institutions, communities have institutional inertia. They want to sort of keep justifying their own existence. And if your existence is about being adversarial, in a way that you're rejecting the mainstream view, then that's a problem as well. But yeah, no, I think more broadly, a common account of vaccine refusal points to this sort of bias literature, either by name or sort of implicitly by saying vaccine refusers are excessively emotional, or they have very naive stories about what causes vaccine complications or about diseases, or they don't have any memories of people who suffer from measles or polio, or they're subject to groupthink. And I think that's probably right. And I think there's good evidence for that. But of course, all the rest of us do that too. And there's every reason to think, for example, that pediatricians, most of them are not doing bench science on vaccine immunology, and that parents who vaccinate certainly are not doing that. Rather, we're all sort of relying on various cognitive shortcuts and various kinds of epistemic trust. But the problem for the denialists is that they're sort of cut off from expert communities. And so people who are vaccinating, it's in many ways a matter of luck that they have good feelings about their pediatricians, or that they have convenient, simple stories they can tell. Right. And so and these convenient, simple stories are all over the place. So it's common for people to say, oh, there's been outbreaks of pertussis recently. That's because of vaccine refusal. And in fact, that's not true. Vaccine refusal has contributed in small ways to recent pertussis outbreaks. But the real cause of that has been reformulation of the pertussis vaccine from the 1980s that has an immunity that wanes much faster than the previous version of that vaccine. So we're all subject to the biases. We all rely on heuristics that lead us astray, even pediatricians. And so another reason to think that the deficit account is going to be insufficient is that we can't show that vaccine refusers are uniquely vulnerable to these sorts of biases.
Well, let me ask just a question that is sort of – it's not a major theme that gets discussed in the book, although a lot is said around the topic. Do the sort of harder core members of the community, so the vaccine denialists, do they tend to also be conspiracy theorists?
Good. So I think there's some empirical evidence that there's some overlap there. Yeah.
Entirely. And so that would be not only an epistemic community that is committed to, you know, not giving uptake to the mainstream medical community. Mm-hmm. It's committed to something in addition, which is not only not giving them uptake, but also treating them with a kind of suspicion that they're sort of a priori committed to saying that whatever they say is just another deception. Is that?
That's right. But I think that's true of a very small minority of vaccine refusers, right? The very large majority of vaccine refusers actually vaccinate against some diseases. And even those who refuse all vaccines, I think I wouldn't say a majority of them, or I wouldn't say the evidence suggests the majority of them are conspiracy theorists. And in fact, one thing that I think is very important that motivates this book, because much of it is an account to say that most vaccine refusers are not as unreasonable as you might think they are. A lot of what motivates that is that there are a lot of persuadable vaccine hesitant and even sort of moderately vaccine refusing parents. And if you treat all of them as if they are in the core 1% who are refusing all vaccines or cannot be reached, then you're missing a huge opportunity to engage constructively with people who might be persuadable.
Right. Does one of the other sort of defects of this kind of epistemic community, so the persisting and seemingly sturdy view that certain vaccines are connected to autism, despite the fact that there's not really evidence for this? Is this part of the
story? Yeah, I think that explanation gets overplayed. And I think
okay.
So I really, one thing that led me to write this book was Mark Largent, who's a historian of science at Michigan State. He wrote a great book in 2012 about vaccine refusal and more from a sort of historian's point of view. But one thing he argues, and I think he's quite right, is that debates between vaccine refusers and vaccine advocates are often proxy debates for debates about larger values in particular. And so he argues persuasively, I think, that the vaccines causing autism is not really about the autism, right? And the reason that it continues even after the evidence shows demonstrably that vaccines, in particular MMR, don't contribute to autism. The reason that this concern continues is that it's about something else. It's about worries I discuss in the book. I think about, among other things, different ideals about what childhood is, different ideals about what healthcare is, different ideas that are connected to a cluster of commitments, including purity or cleanliness or sanctity or the natural or avoidance of toxins. So one way to put this is the most common reason that vaccine refusers give for refusing vaccines is they believe vaccines are unsafe. But the same parents who say they think vaccines are unsafe often accept the scientific consensus about the rates of vaccine complications. So their safety concern is not a matter of science denialism, but it's a matter of ways in which their different values are leading them to make different judgments about how to think about that risk or to think about other risks. So there's a long history of vaccine refusers being explicitly motivated by the fact that vaccines contain or are believed to contain the core objects of disgust. So this comes out of the sort of cognitive psychology research on disgust and purity. So, you know, the earliest vaccines came from cowpox pus, and there was a whole worry that people would become contaminated, in some way become less human by having that inserted into their bodies. Of course, vaccines today don't have cowpox pus, but they do have materials in some vaccines that were grown from fetal cell lines, from aborted fetuses. They do have materials that were grown from pieces of animal bodies, like monkey kidneys. There are other things that might seem unnatural or disgusting about vaccines. Many people are worried about toxins. They're worried about aluminum or formaldehyde or mercury products. And no matter what you tell them about how safe those formulations of those ingredients are or how small the amounts are compared to what people are exposed to in their environment, they're still concerned. And I think they're concerned because they're not worried about measurable complications. They've got contamination commitments. They're expressing a sort of broader worry about maybe industrial pollution, which is not a totally irrational thing to be worried about as a sort of general heuristic. You know, when I can choose not to inject industrial byproducts into my body, I'll choose not to do that. That's not a crazy place to begin from.
Right, yeah. Right.
And I think just one more point on this. I think we parents and especially mothers are encouraged to be hypervigilant about the foods they feed their children, about the products that they give to their kids, about whether there are flame retardants on their children's pajamas or BPA plastics in their toys. And this maternal hypervigilance, we see it play out, I think, here in terms of vaccine refusal as well.
Right. And this connects with especially the stuff on disgust. You have a nice discussion in the book about the conception of the natural that sometimes drives us. Can you tell us more explicitly a little bit just about that, the nature of that? Because it does have a gendered aspect to it as well, doesn't it?
Well, say another bit about that question. I'll know where that's going.
Well, so that there's something about what a natural family is or what natural nurturing relationship is, that it's somehow unmediated by human artifacts.
No, that's right. That's right. So at least some vaccine refusers are not as worried about maybe these so-called toxic ingredients in vaccines, but they just think that that health shouldn't involve such a reliance on technology. In fact, the earliest forms of vaccine refusers at the end of the 19th, into the 20th century were also parts of the physical culture movement that brought us the idea of gyms and eating health foods. So like, you know, Kellogg and the sanatorium movements and such, bodybuilding, right? The early bodybuilding culture in America was also characterized by vaccine refusals. And in fact, there's a delightfully frightening book, children's book that came out in Australia a few years ago called Melanie's Marvelous Measles that describes how wonderful it is to have a childhood where you get a disease naturally and you naturally recover. Because you've been eating organic foods and you've been getting lots of exercise and fresh air, but that the children who eat candy and get vaccines, they have this sort of contaminated, less natural, less flourishing life for those reasons. And that's not – I mean, this is continuous with other sort of natural ideals we have in the culture today. And I think one way in which it's gendered is the idea of natural is a way of talking, expressing commitments to naturalness – in the vaccine debate, are connected with ways of thinking about our anxieties about the demise of middle-class motherhood. There's a long history of contamination worries being attached to cultural change. So you see, for example, in the 1980s, there was a lot of there were contamination myths about fast food restaurants that were tied explicitly to the entry of middle-class women into the workforce. And I think it's no coincidence that vaccine refusers are often attached to, committed to intensive forms of parenting, specifically mothering practice, and often call themselves natural or alternative parenting practices, and where that natural motherhood consists of a rejection of vaccines. You often hear them say things like, well, I do extended breastfeeding because my breast milk is medicine and my breast milk is vaccine. I don't need this artificial intervention in my child's healthcare.
Right. So great. We've got a sense now of the hard questions in epistemology that you reference in the subtitle of the book, and how those questions in epistemology are tempered by different value commitments. But the latter chapters of the book, particularly, start moving into sort of policy questions about social ethics and even political philosophy. So let me ask the sort of the kind of blunt question, and then we can get into some of the more nuanced dimensions of it. Do you think that there's a parental right to refuse vaccination?
So I don't think there's a moral right, okay. Though not for the reasons that most people, at least good. In the debate, seem to think. There clearly are legal rights, and then the question is whether the state has a right to at the very least, incentivize vaccination or disincentivize not vaccinating. And I think the state certainly has that right. So unpack that if you like.
Sure.
Just go into that then, yeah?
Yeah.
So I think the most – so I've been working recently after the book's come out with local public health people, and it's striking – two things are striking. One is how quickly they embrace the deficit model. So when we were brainstorming about ways to expand vaccine compliance, which is their term, a weird term, vaccine compliance, sort of obedience. Education and knowledge is top on their list. People don't know enough. But also, they make utilitarian arguments, right? Like, people just need to know that it's for the greater good. Some people are going to have vaccine complications. But on balance, if everyone's vaccinated, or almost everyone's vaccinated, we're going to have a much healthier community. And it's totally sensible that someone from this sort of bureaucratic point of view, right, just managing finite resources and looking for the health of the community, would make a sort of utilitarian argument. But it's also very reasonable for individual parents not to take up that point of view when it comes to decisions about their children. And I think the failure of public health officials to confront the sort of weakness of a utilitarian justification of a moral duty to vaccinate does a disservice, right? And so there was a movie out a couple of years ago by some vaccine refusers entitled The Greater Good. And it sort of argued that mass vaccination programs were, you know, allowing some children to be sacrificed for the health of the community, and that this was wrong. And with direct and frankly over the top comparisons to Nazi medical experiments and such.
Right.
And so, but I think advocates of vaccination do themselves a disservice when they embrace these arguments. Clearly, I don't think philosophers are doing this, but in as much as I have something to say to them, I want to rely on, I think, more deontological arguments about moral reasons to vaccinate.
Right. So could you tell us a little bit about why you think there's you give this sort of free rider kind of argument?
Yeah. So maybe so that's a sort of harder case. And maybe I'll come back to that. The first, I think, is just a duty to take reasonable means not to place other people at avoidable risk of significant harm. Right, choosing not to vaccinate your child is choosing to place your neighbor who has leukemia or your great grandmother with a compromised immune system at risk of death. And if at minimal risk yourself, you can do that. I think that's a very stringent duty. I also think it's a stringent duty. Maybe it doesn't become more stringent, but be more attentive to the stringency of that duty when we reflect on the historical context of vaccination programs. For a very, very long time, the most coercive public vaccination programs have been aimed at immigrants and at poor and otherwise oppressed members of the population, such that wealthier and more privileged and whiter people have been able to impose risks on others because other people have allowed them to do so. But I think that sort of argument needs to be made. I think it's not as strong, the harm prevention argument is not as strong as people sometimes think, because when herd immunity is robust, that is to say, when a supermajority, upwards of 80 to 95%, depending on the vaccine, when these numbers of people are vaccinated, you're not actually increasing the risk of infecting other people significantly. Harm prevention defenses of a moral duty or a political right to either vaccinate or impose vaccination are sort of slippery in this way.
Right.
And so I think the stronger argument or the more stable argument are fairness-based arguments, so arguments against free riding on herd immunity.
Right. And could you run us through
Of course. So I think that first, the way in which these arguments normally get made, I think, don't go through, but we can still save them. So the easy way to make this argument is to say that people who don't vaccinate take unfair advantage of the fact that other people have. So other people have contributed to this public good of herd immunity. That is to say that it's much less likely that they're going to be infected. And so when they choose not to vaccinate, they take advantage of this in an unfair way. So putting aside the sort of Nozick-style worries about sort of duties of fair play to contribute to goods that others have contributed and you didn't contract yourself into, putting that aside, there's a sort of conceptual problem, namely that people who create herd immunity don't actually benefit from it in a direct way, because they're not – people who create herd immunity by becoming vaccinated, by developing individual immunity, are protected by their individual immunity. They are no longer relying on herd immunity for protection against disease in the first place. So it's in some ways wrong to think about herd immunity as a public good. And I think the literature doesn't reflect that sufficiently. The way to save it, the idea of a public good associated with herd immunity, is to speak about the protection against outbreaks is really a protection against economic disruption or against political stability, and the investment, therefore, in herd immunity is an investment in a more stable and flourishing society. It's parents not having to stay home with their kids during an outbreak, even though their kids are vaccinated. And so everyone does benefit from the goods, but not in this direct way that some people seem to think.
Oh, I see. So the argument then is that the free rider, the free rider is taking advantage of not directly health-related opportunities that are created by others' vaccination. Is that how it would
be? Well, I mean, they are taking advantage of them, but of course, that's the point of cultivating herd immunity. The people who have individual immunity, the reason for them, for lots and lots of them to have individual immunity, is not to protect them because they already have individual immunity. The point is to protect the non-vaccinated. And so you're not free riding on something if the point was to provide it for others. What you are free riding on, though, so I think you can save the idea of there being a public good, that is to say one that's enjoyed by all the members of the community, if you think about the public good of mass vaccination in terms of the broader economic and political benefits that you get out of that. So that's one sort of more sophisticated move I think you have to make. Another worry I have is that, frankly, lots of vaccine refusers are not free riders. Some of them will say, look, I'd be happy for my kids to get measles and polio, given the discussion I have about sort of natural health stuff. Now, maybe they wouldn't be, so maybe these are some false beliefs they have, but many of them are not, at least on the surface, saying, well, I'm happy to refuse vaccines because I know my kids won't get the vaccine. Some of them actually say, well, I'd be happy for this to happen. And in fact, there's sort of emergence of sort of parties, the so-called pox parties, where their kids get chicken pox or get pertussis or and they get together and spread the disease around so that everyone in the community can get it at once.
Really?
Yeah. So they're in many cases not afraid of these diseases. Maybe they should be, but they're not. And so someone who is not refusing because she's counting on the fact that other people are not refusing is not a free rider, right? She's had this good imposed on her that she'd be happy to not have to take advantage of.
Just picking up on this, sort of one of the things that didn't seem to come into your analysis as strongly as it might, and again, I'm just an interloper here. I haven't thought deeply philosophically about some of these issues. Is the putting of the child at risk?
Good, yeah. So I think good. So for the sake of this argument, I'm willing to admit, which I think is false, right, that it can sometimes be in a child's interest to refuse vaccines.
Right.
I think in most cases it's not. But I'm willing to accept that for the sake of the argument, because if it's not, then there's a harder case. Then the parent has to say she has a moral right to act in ways that don't advance a child's interests. Now, I think you can defend that. I think as a parent, there are things I do all day long that don't maximally protect my child's interests, right? I let them watch TV sometimes, and they could be doing a little more reading. I let them play out front, even though there are cars driving by quickly on the street. There's all sorts of things I do that don't maximally promote my kids' interests. And so I think you're not going to get a strong moral reason to vaccinate, especially under conditions of herd immunity, out of concern about what's in the children's best interests.
Okay. Right?
So just much like the harm argument, I think the sort of argument for the best interest of the child is going to be unstable and particularly weak when herd immunity is robust.
Okay. So let's then move to what looks like a neighbor, sort of a question in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
About what states have the right to do. So what does your view about the moral right mean for the state? Does the state get to impose or coerce vaccination?
Good. So some terminology might be helpful and maybe a bit of history. Some people talk about the state imposing vaccination or compelling vaccination. States have almost never compelled vaccination. There's been almost no cases of states under at least legally, right, going door to door with police officers and with syringes. So this almost never happened. Even the Supreme Court cases, so Jacobson versus Massachusetts that was invoked later to justify coercive sterilization, even Jacobson in 1905, I believe, only upheld the right of the state to impose a fine, a small fine. That was like $10.
Right.
Maybe it's bigger than $10 is more in 1905, but not that much,
right.
On a parent who refused a vaccine. So really when we talk about coercive vaccination policy, we're talking about imposing costs on people who refuse a vaccine or withdrawing social or other services or opportunities they'd otherwise be entitled to. So we're denying them access to some workplaces, right? You can't join the military or work in the health professions if you don't get vaccinated. We're denying them access to daycare or schools or in many cases institutions of higher education if they're not vaccinated.
Which can be pretty high cost.
They're high cost. I'm happy to call them coercive, but I think when people talk about compulsory vaccination, imposing vaccination, that's not been a part of vaccination policy, and no one is or should be advocating that, I think. So that's that. So can we do this? Well, I mean, I think many of the arguments for moral duty to vaccinate identify reasons that you can give people for why the state can use coercion to promote vaccination. So harm-based arguments certainly should be accepted as reasons for state coercion. And I think also fairness-based arguments, right? So one thing a government ought to be doing is developing and maintaining valuable public goods and ensuring that people make a fair distribution to those public goods. I got to pay my taxes for the roads and bridges. And even though you could privatize the roads and bridges, you can't privatize herd immunity. And so we're going to need someone to make sure that we're making fair contributions to that very, very valuable public good. Now, one thing I want to say, especially when it comes to coercion, this matters to the moral arguments as well, but it especially matters to the coercive arguments, is that there's no such thing as vaccines. There are individual vaccines. And that the reasons, both moral reasons for getting them, but also the sort of reasons for state coercion differ depending on the vaccines. So one thing I'm critical of public health officials for is invoking the specter of smallpox, right, which has killed untold hundreds of millions of people, to justify coercive state measures or to try and justify coercive state measures for other vaccines. Smallpox is chickenpox is not smallpox. Right. Healthy children have almost no complications ever from chickenpox. Certainly, the varicella virus contributes to shingles, causes shingles, which is a very bad disease. But again, nothing like smallpox. But there are other issues too. So the degree of control over one's exposure matters, right? So we think that if we can be more responsible for harm and maybe the state has less permission to protect people or force people to protect us from those harms if we can control our exposure to that harm. So, you can't control your exposure to measles. Right? A kid with measles walks into a room with 200 other people. An hour later, after walking around, everyone's been exposed. But HPV is transmitted primarily through intravenous drug use and sexual activity. And while certainly those activities aren't always entirely voluntary, there's a different degree of control that we often have about whether or not we're going to have a risk of HPV imposed upon us. I think that matters. And then some diseases are just not contagious. Tetanus is not contagious. And so harm-based arguments are not going to work for tetanus. And fairness-based arguments aren't going to work either, because there can be no herd immunity against a disease that's not contagious.
Right.
Yeah.
So the language then about the strategy of arguing, using the specter of smallpox as a way to defend vaccination as such.
Yeah.
You're saying.
And the United States is rather unique in this way. So in Western Europe, for example, there are very few vaccine mandates at all in those countries. But when there are vaccine mandates, they're almost always disease-specific. So many countries have only vaccine mandates for measles and polio vaccine, for example. The other ones are encouraged and, of course, free or heavily subsidized, and their vaccine uptake rates are quite high. But there's vaccine-specific distinctions when it comes to the role of the state in promoting that. And I think it's a problem that America's not gone that way, because parents can reason about, I had chickenpox and lots of people had chickenpox, and this is not smallpox, this is not measles. And I see it in vaccine advocates I talk to, a willingness to sort of continue to add to the list of mandated vaccines. Whereas it seems clear to me that when there are diminishing returns on the sort of cost-benefit analysis, we ought to be skeptical about whether we want the state using its power to force people to vaccinate.
Right. There's an old sort of philosopher's idea, like coercion, even when it's justified, still needs to be sparing. Good. So if then the argument is that there are coercive measures, we'll say, that the state is justified in employing in order to increase vaccination levels, then the question comes up about non-medical kinds of exemptions.
That's right.
And this is where the book ends. So, and the more general philosophical thought is, even in cases where the state is justified in doing something, there might be distinctive kinds of reasons why, for certain communities or maybe just certain citizens,
that's right,
they should be spared or not subject to the coercive measures.
That's right. That's right.
Tell us a little bit about
that. So I think states, my general view is that states ought to be offering non-medical exemptions to vaccine mandates, which is to say that parents who object to vaccines for reasons of personal belief or religious conviction or personal integrity ought to be allowed in some occasions to send their kids to school and daycare, even if they're not fully vaccinated. But I don't think that we get there in a really straightforward manner that some vaccine policy critics argue. So it's common to see arguments that, parental rights justify expansive exemptions programs. And so first, I don't argue they don't, but I also argue that if they do, then they actually get too much. If parents ought to have these sort of rights, then to make all decisions about their children's health care, then you can't get coercive vaccination off the ground in the first place. Likewise, you see an argument about informed consent, which is really collapses to an argument about parental autonomy and parental rights that I think similarly doesn't get you an account of exemptions. So what we need instead is an argument where we get that's consistent with the justice of a general law that has coercive force behind vaccination, but that admits of exceptions. And I think there are a couple different ways to not get that. I've become more sympathetic with arguments from liberal justice for exemptions. I think if you can show that parents who are refusing have reasons for objecting, if you can show that they face unique burdens if you compelled them to vaccinate or excluded them, or say their children from school and daycare, and if you can show that they don't have any third-party harms, that to say if their children's failure to be vaccinated would not undermine herd immunity, then I think there can be a compelling case for exemptions. Here I go a little bit beyond what I say in the book. But that to the side, I think the most compelling case for exemptions is a pragmatic case. And so maybe if I talk about the experience of California. So we're recording this a couple days before the July 1st, 2016 kickoff date for California's new policy that prohibits parents from enrolling children in school and daycare unless they're fully vaccinated, with no permission for exemptions based on religious or personal belief grounds. So they've eliminated all exemptions. Even if you think that parents aren't entitled as a matter of justice to exemptions, I think people are going to be surprised at what happens. There's already evidence that parents are going to place pressure on enrollment-dependent private and charter schools to accept provisional admittance of the under-vaccinated children. There's already organizing for acts of civil disobedience, so parents showing up with their under-vaccinated kids at school and not leaving. I think if we see on the news images of parents and small children being carted away from school in police vans, I don't think that's going to be good PR. And more generally, I worry that this is politically polarizing debates about vaccination policy, but maybe also vaccine policy. So up until this point, up until very recently, beliefs both about vaccination policy and the vaccine science have not been correlated by political ideology. And so unlike GMO science or anthropogenic climate change. But in the states, including California, that's eliminated all medical exemptions, and Vermont, beginning actually in July this year as well, will eliminate all personal belief exemptions. They're holding on to the religious ones, but these are two states that have eliminated in the past year exemptions. They were basically party line votes. They were all Democrats, all and basically only Democrats voting to eliminate the exemptions and Republicans voting for them. You've seen in the current presidential or the presidential primary that's just wrapped up, both Donald Trump, Rand Paul, and Chris Christie, all advocating for expansive exemptions policies and criticizing attempts to restrict exemptions. I think it's a disaster if we see what I think we're starting to see, which is political polarization in beliefs about vaccine policy, because we know, among other things, so that'd be disastrous for vaccine policy, but also that's likely to lead to politically polarized beliefs about the vaccine science. And it's a problem for climate change, but a disaster when you need 95% people to vaccinate for policy to work. So I'm much more sympathetic with policies like my home state has undertaken. In Michigan, we have continued to allow people to be exempted for any reason they want, but we require them now to show up at the local public health department for a half-hour education session. Now, the state's not naive enough to think they actually change anyone's mind, but there's good evidence that imposing additional burdens, making it less easy to take advantage of the exemptions, can lower the exemptions rates. And so if we can preserve the liberties that parents have been accustomed to, even if they're not entitled to them, while lowering exemptions rates, then we should be doing that. And in fact, Michigan had a almost 40% reduction in its exemptions rates last year with this new policy.
Interesting. So let me ask then, just and this is going a little bit beyond the book. So in the states like California, as you were just saying, that have sort of eliminated all exemptions.
Yeah. Well, all the non-medical ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Is there a sense of what the reasoning is?
So I've got a thing, a couple of things that I hope are coming out on this this issue and other issues in exemptions policies. I'm very disappointed. So in 2012 in California, they passed a bill that actually imposed greater burdens on people, parents who wanted exemptions. They made them have to go and talk, not the public health department like Michigan, but they had to talk to their physician and get their physician to sign a form. And it was working. In the first year after it was imposed, there were significant declines in exemptions rates and increases in the vaccination rates. But you had a Democratic supermajority in the legislature, including some of the bill's authors. Here we're talking about Senate Bill 277 in California, who were physicians and who got freaked out about the 2014-2015 Disneyland measles outbreak. Right. And they felt like we have to do something now, even though the evidence was showing their previous policy was working. So I think I remark in the book or somewhere else that here is perhaps a case of biased reasoning on the part of vaccine advocates who are latching on to especially emotionally evocative high-profile events and failing to pay attention to statistical evidence about the efficacy of a less coercive policy.
Right.
Yeah, so these guys, the state senators who sponsored the bill limiting non-medical exemptions in California, I mean, they're sort of villains in my story, even though I agree with them that vaccination is super important. All three of my kids are fully vaccinated. I think vaccines are really important, which is why I think we need to be careful about using coercion
right.
When we don't need it.
And so I suspect the answer to this is no, but, you know, there is a pretty, well, I should say a notorious, I tended to think pretty strong anti-exemption argument that was raised by Brian Barry about 10 years ago that just said, you know, any argument for exemption is really just an argument against there being a law at all.
That's right.
Is there any reason to think that reasoning like that has driven any of the push to eliminate the non-medical exemptions? That if we allow non-medical exemptions, then it looks as if the law just, you know, we're really just chipping away at the law and conceding that the law, that there shouldn't be a law governing this sphere of activity at all? Or is that just not
good? No, that's a great point. And in fact, said earlier, the vaccine sort of advocates, activists in vaccine refusing communities, are quite clear that they don't want coercive vaccination anyway, right? That's their ultimate thing they want to attack, and they see protecting exemptions as a way to get half a loaf. I think there are very few people, and I think vaccine advocates on the other side, right, say, well, we shouldn't have exemptions because there's a general law, and if the general law is justified, then I think you can hew a middle ground. I've become a little more sympathetic with this argument than I was in the book, where if you can show that these parents have reasons, perhaps there are reasons of religious conviction, perhaps there are reasons of sort of underlying lifestyle commitments. If you can show that reasons for objecting, if you can show that they are going to be subject to undue and unique burdens, and if you can show if they're compelled to vaccinate or compelled not to attend school or daycare, which I think is the other disaster in California. Undervaccinated and unvaccinated children are exactly the children you want under state supervision. These are not the children you want thrown into homeschooling communities, which are amazingly unregulated. So there are huge burdens there. And if you can show that there's not going to be a third party harm, if you can show that herd immunity can tolerate 1-2 or 3-4% exemption rate, then I think you can have a reason for both a general law and an exemption. I'm more sympathetic with that argument than I was before. But I also think that's not doing most of the work. What's doing most of the work are these pragmatic and political considerations.
I see. Great. Well, you've been generous with your time. So,
thank you, Bob. This has been fun.
What's next with your, what will happen next with you? Are you going to continue to pursue?
Sure.
Sounds like you're continuing to pursue some of these questions.
Yeah. I've got a project where I'm thinking about food ethics and food justice and some papers on that. But the vaccine stuff has been occupying a lot of my time. I've got a couple of papers. One of them that I'm writing with Mark Largent from Michigan State on exemptions policies. I've got a couple papers on physician-parent communication and ideas about parental autonomy, including the use of the nudges, the tools from behavioral economics. And then I'm really excited. I've started with collaborators both at my institution at Michigan State and the local public health department some empirical research projects. Much of my book is about how vaccine advocates misunderstand the concerns and the commitments of people who are refusing vaccines. While I offer a bunch of speculative arguments, I'm a philosopher and I haven't done the empirical work. And I thought, well, why not? I'll make some friends in psychology and in sociology who will go and do this work with me. So we have surveyed parents who've come in for these education sessions at Michigan Public Health Departments about their concerns. We're starting next month some focus groups for the public health nurses who are doing these education sessions to better understand what's going on there. And then we're also going to review the complete immunization records for all of the children who received exemptions, starting in my local county, but I'm hoping expanding elsewhere. So 4,000 records, which we can link to information about the educators and the sort of arguments and strategies the educators used in those interventions. So I really want to learn more. And I think I've exhausted my philosophical tools, and I'm a philosopher who's learned how to go through an IRB process and do some bit of empirical research.
Well, that all sounds fascinating. You should definitely keep me posted about these projects. All that sounds great. But for now, let me just thank you for spending some time today to talk to us about your book, Values and Vaccine Refusal.
Bob, thank you. This was delightful.
Great. I will. I'll be in touch. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Mark Navin of Oakland University. We were talking about his new book, Values and Vaccine Refusal, Hard Questions in Ethics, Epistemology, and Healthcare, which is newly published by Routledge. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.